Now, friends, in the book History and Principles of Literary Criticism, the other chapter we start is Greco-Roman Criticism, Longinus, on the Sublime. The first major subheading in this chapter is uncertainty regarding its date and authorship. The exact date and authorship of the Greek treatise on the Sublime, attributed to one Longinus, has been a matter of much critical wrangling. It was in 1554 that the Italian critic Robertello first presented the work to the modern readers and ascribed it to a rhetorician named Dionysius Longinus, and this authorship was generally accepted up to the beginning of the 19th century. Then some critics pointed out that the work belonged to that Longinus who was the famous minister of Genovia, Queen of Palmyra, Palmyra. In recent times, R.A. Scott James has subscribed to this view. The controversy still goes on, and who its author actually was still remains uncertain. Therefore, the traditional authorship is retained and the work is simply assigned to one Longinus. In the absence of any definite information, this name is as good as any other to stand for the unknown. Similarly, there is a controversy regarding its date of composition. 19th century critics tended to assign it to the 3rd century AD. However, there is ample evidence to establish that the work must have been written in the latter half of the 1st century AD, neither much earlier nor much later. In the very beginning, we are told that the treatise was written to correct the faults of an essay on the same subject by one Caecilius, Caecilius, who is definitely known to have belonged to the 1st century AD. Moreover, there are constant references in the work of contemporary oratory and orators and an analysis of the causes of its decline. The decline of eloquence was a burning topic of the age, and the treatise has been professedly professedly written to correct contemporary faults of style. It has all the appearance of a work written to meet some pressing need of the time. Therefore, we must accept the latter half of the 1st century AD as the most likely date of its composition. Now, the other subheading. On the Sublime, its fragmentary nature, its significance. On the Sublime is a critical document of great worth and significance. It is most precious legacy of the Greco-Roman period to literary criticism in the modern age. No doubt, it is unfortunate that it has come down to us in an imperfect form. Large portions are missing and there are frequent and extensive gaps. It has been calculated that as much as one-third of the original document is missing. Thus, we have only a part of the actual work, but what we have is sufficient to make plain the intention of its author. The document, imperfect as it is, contains such abundance of good things that it must be considered as one of the choicest pieces of criticism that have come down to us from antiquity. The third topic, subheading is its plan. Despite its apparent formlessness, the treatise has a well-marked structure. It is addressed to one Terentianus, a friend or a pupil, and after a brief introduction, the writer passes on to the central theme, a discussion of those vices of style which constitute in contemporary oratory a false sublime. This is followed by a section representing the main substance of the treatise, in which are specified the five sources of the sublime as well as the details of the treatment necessary for its attainment. The five sources are said to be grandeur of conception, second, intensity of emotion, the consideration of which is reserved for a separate work, and both of these, as the author points out, are largely the fruit of natural genius. Then follows some accounts of the remaining three sources, which are due primarily to art. Third, the appropriate use of figures. Fourth, nobility of diction. And fifth, dignity and elevation of word order. The work ends with a discussion of the causes of the decay of eloquence, a return to the opening theme, which rounds off the treatment and suggests the motive that has prompted the author throughout. The general plan of the work is thus obvious and clear-cut. The central theme is treated on comprehensive line, embodying an approach to the subject from both the psychological and the technical points of view, while something of the usual rhetorical procedure is also adopted in treating first of subject matter and its arrangement under the head of grandeur of conception, and then of the choice and arrangement of the words in subsequent sections. This was the statement of Atkins. But the treatment is never rigidly systematic. Throughout the work, an easy conversational tone is maintained, rising at times to an appropriate eloquence. And by means of an abundance of illustrative quotations, by his shrewd and convincing analysis of literary qualities, the author succeeds in calling attention to some of the fundamental principles underlying all good writing while commanding them to his readers by the freshness and charm of his style. This is also the statement of Atkins. Then the another subheading is critical synopsis. A brief synopsis of the work is necessary to bring out fully its scope and purpose of its author. The first one is introductory. The writer addresses his friend Terentian, tells him of his purpose, that of correcting the faults of Caecilius' essay on the sublime, and makes some other preliminary observations. B. Sublimity defined and explained. Sublimity is a certain loftiness and excellence in language. It is only through sublimity that the greatest poets and prose writers have derived their eminence and gained immortality. Sublimity doesn't merely persuade, it carries us away almost irresistibly. It expresses itself in the general structure of a work. Sometimes it might express itself even in a single phrase, like a flash of lightning. Third, that is C. Can art teach sublimity or loftiness in writing? Some people think that sublimity is a gift of nature and it has nothing to do with art. They say a lofty tone is inborn and it doesn't come by teaching. Nature is only master that can teach it. However, it must be remembered that nature needs the help of art to control its wild impulses. Nature impulses without artistic control are like a ship let loose on the oceans without a helmsman, H-E-L-M-S-M-A-N. Secondly, it is only by art that a writer can learn when to abandon himself to the direction of genius. Art is to nature what good counsel is to good fortune. The expression of the sublime often needs the spur, but it also needs the curb which is put by art alone. D. Some faults of style. There are some defects of style which tend to spoil the loftiness of language. These faults are timidity or bombast, puerility, grandiloquence, grandiloquence, and frigidity. All these faults arise from the craze for novelty of thought. E. The true and false sublime. The writer then distinguishes between the true sublime and the false sublime. The true sublime uplifts our soul. It arises from lofty ideas clothed in lofty language. It gives us joy and exalts our spirits. The more we read it, the more we enjoy it. Every time it suggests new ideas and feelings. It never grows stale. In short, the true sublime pleases all and pleases always. The false sublime, on the other hand, consists merely of a gorgeous exterior which conceals nothing but emptiness. There is bombast of language, affected, pompous language is used to clothe thoughts which are essentially trivial and puerile, P-E-U-R-I-L-E. There is also cheap display of passion unwarranted by the subject. Then F. The sources of the sublime. There are five principal sources of the sublime. First, grandeur of thought, that is, the power of conceiving great thought. Second, a strong and inspired passion and vigorous treatment of it. Third, the use of figures, A. Figures of thought, and B. Figures of language or expression. Fourth, noble diction, including a proper choice and arrangement of words and handling of metaphor and other ornaments of diction. The fifth point is dignified, elevated, and elaborate composition. By this, Longinus means rhythm. The first two of these sources are inborn gifts of a genius. The others can be acquired by art. Another point, G. Grandeur of thought. Great thoughts spring from great souls. The truly eloquent must be free from low and ignoble thoughts. Men with mean and servile ideas cannot attain sublimity. It is only great minds that produce great literature. Their words are full of sublimity, whose thoughts are full of majesty. Then point H, skillful selection and organization of material. Another thing that contributes to the sublimity of style is the wise and systematic selection of the most important elements, that is, events, emotions or passions, and their combination into a single whole. Then I, amplification. Amplification, that is, the accumulation of relevant and telling details of a subject, is closely associated with sublimity. This imparts force and magnitude to the style. One impressive point after another is brought in a continuous and ascending scale. Then point J, amplification and sublimity distinguished. The distinction between sublimity and amplification is that sublimity consists in elevation while amplification embraces a multitude of details. It gives extension to a subject. Sublimity often comprises single thought while amplification can only subsist with a certain prolixity and diffusiveness. Then point K, imitation as a means to sublimity. The imitation of previous great poets and writers is one of the paths which lead to sublimity. The great masters of antiquity are the standards of excellence. Hence, they should be imitated. The writer may receive a divine impulse from them. He should ask three questions. First, how would Homer or Plato have expressed a particular idea? Second, if Homer or Plato were to listen to what he composed, what would be their reaction? Third, how would future ages judge his composition? Such questioning will stimulate the writer to the sublime. Then point L, the use of figures. The use of vivid figures or images also helps in the creation of the sublime. The writer should first see imaginatively what he describes and then try to produce a similar illusion in his readers. The aim of poetical images is to astound and startle the readers. The aim of rhetorical images is to impart vividness and clearness. Both, however, seek to steer the passions and the emotions. Both kind of images may be used. Then point M. The importance of figures. Figures of speech, if properly handled, contribute to sublimity. But the figures should be employed in the right place, on the right occasion, in the right manner, and with a right motive. Figures should be used in a natural manner. The artificiality of figures rouses suspicion and anger. Art lies in concealing art. Wherefore, a figure is at its best when the very fact that it is a figure escapes attention. Then point N, the various figures and their uses. One of the common figures in adjuration and apostrophe. It is an effective use of an appeal or address to steer the emotions. The rhetorical use of questions and answers often makes the language more effective and impressive. The language becomes not only more elevated but also more convincing. The device steers the readers or the listeners and gives energy to the words. But these questions should spring from a natural outburst of passion and should be inspired by the occasion. They should strike as being quite natural under the circumstances.
If a question is inspired by a strong passion, the words will flow out spontaneously and will add to the impetuosity of effects. Impetuosity. Impetuosity. Another figure is asyndeton, asyndeton, which consists in the removal of connecting particles. The effect produced is one of rush and torrent of passion. The union of certain figures to attain some particular effect imparts strength, beauty, and persuasiveness to the language. In order to produce a powerful emotional effect, figures such as anaphora, that is repetition of words, and diatyposis, that is vivid description, may be combined together. Such a union imparts vigor, cogency, and beauty to a speech. Hyperbaton is a figure which consists in the inversion of the natural order of words or thoughts. It carries the very effect of violent mental agitation. When a person speaks under the stress of a strong passion, the logical order is often reversed and he jumps from one thought to another. This figure, therefore, gives a touch of reality to speech and produces the natural effect of emotion. Art is perfect when it seems to be nature, and nature hits the mark when she contains art hidden within her. Polyptota, P-O-L-Y-P-T-O-T-A. Polyptota is a figure which consists in the interchange of one case for another, of one number for another, of one tense for another, and of one person for another. It is an excellent weapon of public oratory and contributes to sublimity. It diversifies and enlivens exposition, but it should be used only when the nature of our subject allows it. To overlay every sentence with ornament is very pedantic. Periphrasis also contributes much to the sublime and adds greatly to the beauty of language, but it is to be handled with great discrimination, otherwise it will lose its effect and arouse disgust. Then point O, noble diction and sublimity. The choice of proper and striking words is essential for producing sublimity, because it is through words that a writer expresses himself. Beautiful words are the very light of lofty thought, but inappropriate magnificence of diction should be avoided. For example, trifling subjects should not be treated in a grand manner. Then point P, the use of metaphors. The use of metaphors contributes a great deal to the sublime. Metaphors should, however, be used in impassioned and descriptive passages only. The proper time for using metaphors is when the passion roll like a torrent and sweep a multitude of them down their resistless flood. On such occasions, a number of metaphors can be used together. The use and number of metaphors is determined by the occasion. No fixed rules can be laid down in this connection. Then point Q, a brief digression. A genius with some faults is better than a flawless mediocre. It is not the number but the loftiness of a writer's excellences which counts. Then point R, closely allied to metaphors are comparisons and similes. They also contribute to sublimity. Then point S. Hyperboles. Hyperboles may be used in describing the great as well as the small, since exaggeration is the common element in both cases. Those hyperboles are best in which the very fact that they are hyperboles escapes attention. So naturally should it grow out of the circumstances. In the use of hyperbole, one must not overstep, otherwise the effect would be spoiled. Then point T. Arrangement of words. The harmonious arrangement of words is the fifth source of the sublime. It is a great source of persuasion as well as pleasure. It reaches our souls and contributes to lofty utterance and passion. It is the sense of harmony that gives charm and organic unity to a work of art. A sentence has its own organic structure and it arises from a harmonious arrangement of words. Broken and agitated movement of language spoils dignity and elevation and gives the composition an appearance of meanness. Excessive conciseness of expression also tends to mar the sublime. Deformity instead of grandeur ensues from overcompression. Grandeur is marred, M-A-R-R-E-D. Grandeur is marred when the thought is brought into too narrow a compass. Similarly, overextension also makes the style lifeless. Then point U. The use of mean words should be avoided. Low and undignified vocabulary also disfigures and degrades sublimity. Ill-sounding words and vulgar idioms should therefore be avoided. Then point V. The decline of eloquence in the age, its causes. Some critics are of the view that the decline of truly great literature in their times was due to the lack of incentive which democracy provided to men of genius in their times. They say that the growth of highly exalted genius has ceased. Longinus differs from such critics. He thinks that it is characteristic of human nature always to find fault with the present. The real cause of the decline of eloquence and literature is the moral decline of the people. People attach more importance to the materialistic value of life. They do not exert themselves except for the sake of praise, money, or pleasure. Great literature springs from great and lofty souls, and not from those with whom the world is too much. Then the another subheading and fifth point in this chapter is the sublime, its nature and definition. Even a cursory reading of the text is sufficient to show that Longinus has not used the word sublime in its modern, narrow and limited sense. What Longinus means by the word sublime is elevation or loftiness, all that raises style above the ordinary and gives to it distinction in its widest and truest sense. This distinction was present in the earliest Greek masterpieces and it gives them their permanent value, but this distinction is entirely lacking in the work of his contemporaries. Thus, by sublimity, Longinus means a certain distinction and excellence in composition. The effect of this quality is not mere persuasion or pleasure, but transport. That is to say, it works like a charm carrying irresistible away with it all readers and hearers. The effect is as immediate as it is subtle. SUBTLE. It doesn't result from a painstaking observance of the rules of rhetoric. To quote his own words, sublimity flashing forth at the right moment scatters everything before it like a thunderbolt, and at once displays the power of an orator in all its plenitude. Passages like these have led R.A. Scott James to call Longinus the first romantic critic. In order to explain further the nature of sublime, Longinus compares the true sublime with the false sublime. The false sublime is characterized first by tumidity or bombast of language, which is as great an evil as swellings in the body. It is drier than dropsy. Secondly, the false sublime is characterized by puerility, which is a parade and pomp of language, tawdry and affected, and so frigid. Thirdly, the false sublime results when there is a cheap display of passion, when it is not justified by the occasion and show is wearisome. Contemporary literature was falsely sublime, and all these ugly and parasitical growths in literature arise from a single cause, that pursuit of novelty in the expression of ideas which may be regarded as the fashionable craze of the day. True sublime, on the other hand, pleases all and pleases always, for it expresses thoughts of universal validity, thoughts common to men of all ages and countries, in a language which instinctively uplifts our souls. Then, the other subheading of this chapter is Ways of Acquiring It, Nature and Art. Next, Longinus examines how this true sublimity can be acquired and points out that both nature and art are equally necessary. However, the course of discussion shows that in truth he considers that such skills is inborn, it doesn't come by teaching, and that indeed genius itself shrivels up at the touch of the rules. However, art has its own place. Its function is twofold. In the first place, it provides a safeguard against undue license, and it explains to man nature's method of expression. Fine writing needs the crub as well as the spur. Then the other subheading, its sources. There are five sources of this distinction, loftiness or sublimity. A. First and most important source is grandeur of conception or lofty and awe-inspiring thoughts. B. Vehement, V-E-H-E-M-E-N-T, vehement and inspired passion. C. Use of figures, which are of two kinds, figures of thought and figures of language. D. Noble diction, which is the result of choice and arrangement of words, use of images and metaphors and similes and comparisons. And E. Dignified, elevated, and elaborate composition. The first two sources are innate or natural, while the remaining three are the products of art. Thus, art and nature both contribute to the sublime or loftiness of style. Then, taking all these points one by one, let's see first grandeur of thought. Grandeur of thought is the first essential, for noble and lofty thoughts find their natural expression in lofty language. Lofty thought itself is an echo of greatness of soul. Such greatness and nobility of soul can be cultivated by neurizing the mind on the thoughts that are elevating. Mean and ignoble thoughts can never inspire a lofty utterance. Therefore, he who would attain distinction of style must feed his soul on the works of the great masters, as Homer, and capture from them some of their own greatness. This reflects the classicism of Longinus. However, what Longinus has in his mind is not mere imitation or borrowing, but that men catch fire from the spirit of others.
The imitation he here advocates is worlds apart from the formal copying usually associated with that term. It is different too from Horace's rather loftier conception, which stood for an assimilation of ancient methods with a view of producing something new. To Longinus, the operation is not that dot to Longinus, the operation is not that aims at capturing something of the ancient spirit, something of that vital creative force which had gone to the making of the earlier masterpieces, and its effect he describes as that of illumination, guiding the mind in some mysterious way to the lofty standards of the ideal. Here, then, is something new in the critical outlook, a recognition of that imaginative stimulus derived from great creative genius, as well as an interpretation of imitation that raised it to a higher place. And it is such theorizing as this that constitutes the greatness of Longinus. This is the statement of J.W.H. Atkins. This grandeur of conception is to be emphasized and made effective by a suitable treatment of material. Details should be so chosen as to form an organic whole. Amplification, that is, accumulation of all the details of a given subject, is also helpful. Such amplification, by its profusion, suggests overwhelming strength and magnitude. The use of vivid and compelling images is also useful, for it brings home to the readers the conception of the writer effectively and forcefully. Then B. Passion. The second source of sublime is vehement and inspired passion. Longinus asserts that nothing contributes more to loftiness of tone in the writing than genuine emotion. However, the topic has been dealt with in detail. The author declares his intention of dealing with it in a second treatise, which unfortunately has not come down to us. Then C. The use of figures. The third source of attaining excellence of style is use of figures, which he considers very important, and so devotes nearly one third of his work to it. He shows great discrimination and originality of thinking in his treatment of the subject. Figures should not be used mechanically, rather they must be rooted in genuine emotion. Used naturally, they impart elevation to style and are themselves made more effective by an elevated style. They are the result of art, but they should be so used that art is concealed. This becomes possible only when the style is elevated for an elevated style, casts a veil over artifice. A figure is most effective when the fact that it is a figure is happily concealed, and it is concealed by a splendor of style. Longinus does not deal with all figures, but only with those that give distinction of style. The figures treated are rhetorical question, asyndeton or the omission of conjunction, hyperbaton or inversion, and periphrasis. And his main contention throughout is that figures properly treated are a valuable means of giving emotional quality to style, thus supplementing by devices of art the animation or ardor which normally results from the genuine emotion of the speaker or writer. And his views are illustrated from a number of eminent masters of the past. Hyperbaton, anaphora or repetition of words, apostrophe or addresses to abstract or inanimate object, asyndeton or the figure in which conjunction are left out, and the various figures embodying changes of syntax are all useful in heightening the expression. They create something of the breathless vehemence, the studied disorder, and the air of unpremeditation characteristic of impassioned utterance. This is the statement of Atkins. It is, in short, an example of artistic expression reproducing the effects of natural expression, a principle emphasized by Longinus in his statement that art is perfect when it seems to be nature, and nature hits the mark when she contains art hidden within her. Various variations of syntax, that is plural for the singular, present for the past, etc., have a far-reaching enlivening effect. Periphrasis, that is a roundabout way of saying things by which the use of commonplace words is avoided, adds to the expression a richer note and more tuneful rhythms, and thus helps in the expression of lofty thoughts. However, the figure should be used with care, otherwise it degenerates into a trivial and cumbrous form of expression, as it did actually happen in the 18th century English poetry. In short, the use of figures must be psychological, intimately connected with thought and emotion, and not merely mechanical. Then D. Diction. The fourth source of sublime is diction, which includes choice and arrangement of words as well as the use of metaphor and simile. Both ordinary and striking words must be suitably chosen, for both are necessary for the formation of an impressive style. He declares that what gives to literature its enduring charm, whether it be the quality of grandeur or beauty or mellowness or force in the last resort, it is this verbal magic which invests dead things with a sort of living voice. Beautiful words, he adds, are the truth, the very light of thought, and it may safely be said that nowhere in the work does longinus approach more nearly to the mysteries of art than in this suggestive and striking pronouncement of his. Further, he issues a warning against the indiscriminate use of stately words. To employ magnificent diction, he states, in connection with trivial matters would be about as effective as to put on a child a man's tragic mask. On the other hand, he has a word of approval for homely and tracy expressions in the proper place. This is the statement of J.W.H. Atkins. Next, he takes up the use of metaphor and displays a similar breadth of outlook and penetration of insight. One would have supposed that he would include metaphor, the queen of figures, and simile and comparison under the heading of figures, but to our surprise, they are discussed under diction. Metaphors are necessary to give elevation to a style. No rules can be laid down as to number of metaphors which may be used in a passage. With the insight of genius, he brushes aside all rules and boldly asserts that the passion which gives rise to metaphors will not only determine their number, but will provide the necessary control over their numbers. Thus, impassioned utterance, he explains, demands the use of these striking turns, often in a sustained series, so that there can be no fixed limit to the number used. Then, too, a reader steered doesn't stop to count or weigh up metaphors. Carried away by emotion, he needs no other means of controlling or checking any excess in their use. And in this way, it is implied, does passion help metaphor, and metaphor passion, the relation between the two being of a natural and fundamental kind. This is the statement of J.W.H. Atkins. Along with the use of metaphors, he also considers the use of hyperboles, which he says must also arise from emotion. Hyperbole must not be overdone, for the exaggerated hyperbole results not in elevation but in bathos. According to Wimsatt and Brooks, the view of Longinus is that it is only a strong and timely passion which can make us shallow, a far-fetched, F-E-T-C-H-E-D, metaphor, or a violent hyperbole. The other point, that is point E, dignified composition. Then he proceeds to consider the fifth source of sublime, dignified and noble composition and arrangement. By arrangement and composition, he simply means a verbal order which is usually called rhythm. Words must be harmoniously set, for the resulting harmony is a natural instrument, not only of persuasion and pleasure, but of lofty emotion as well. Such harmonious combination of words appeals to the soul and enables the reader to share in the emotions of the author. Foremost among the rhythms that make for grandeur of utterance is said to be the dactylic, D-A-C-T-Y-L-I-C, dactylic, upon which, as Longinus reminds his readers, that most beautiful of meters, the hexameter, is built. On the other hand, weak and broken rhythms made up of pyrex, PHYRRHICH, torches and the like are instrumental solely in lowering the dignity of a passage. But show, adds Longinus, does also writing in which the rhythm is too pronounced, for there it is the quality of the rhythm rather than the meaning of the words that engages the attention, and the effect is said to be not unlike that of dance music, to which hearers were wont to keep time with their feet. Atkins. He issues a further warning against undue conscienceness of expression. Extreme conciseness, as he points out, cramps and cripples the thought, whereas brevity, in the true sense, is effective because of its economy and directness. Also, Longinus briefly points out that the use of simile and comparison too is helpful in achieving a splendor of style. Then the sixth subheading is some incidental matters, suggestive richness. Such are the views of Longinus on the sublime, but the treatise also deals with a host of other incidental matters. Great is the variety of this small work. Say, Wimstedt and Brooks, one of the most extraordinary features of the essay on the sublime is the variety of criteria, the number of approaches to poetry which it manages to include, not only the main three, the transport of the audience, the genius of the author, the devices of the rhetoric, but in passing the democratic idea that great poetry is that which pleases all and always. And again, a further variation on the subject-object relation. The most spectacular or operatic part of the essay, the idea of physical grandeur as the counterpart of psychic. For example, the decay of eloquence in the age is examined and its causes pointed out. Decline and degradation of literature result not from the rise of democracy and the collapse of monarchy, but from a degradation and corruption of the human soul. People have grown greedy, corrupt, materialistic, shameless, and insolent, and so art and literature suffered. He constantly illustrates his views with reference to the works of the Greek and Roman masters, and such digressions, explanations, illustrations, and the like, incidentally supply further relevant passages in which fresh light is thrown on such matters as critical standards and critical methods. The seventh point, and the subheading is Excellence in Literature, Its Test. The treatise, ostensibly on a style, widens considerably in scope and becomes one on literary criticism in the larger sense of the term. Nothing, for instance, is of more lasting value than the remarks of our author on the standards for forming judgment in literature. It is a subject on which he has not a little to say, and such judgment he describes as an arduous business, indeed, the crowning fruit of ripe experience. To some extent, it would be true to say that his standard of taste is implied in what has already been said concerning distinction in the style, so that for him the qualities of great utterance are likewise the qualities of great literature. Hence, as his first criterion of excellence in literature, he demands the presence of an imaginative and emotional appeal, the power that is of uplifting the soul of the reader and of filling him with joy and pride by arousing in him noble thoughts and suggesting more than the words actually convey. And here it will be noticed the test is no longer that of mere pleasure or persuasion, nor is the appeal made to the emotions or the intellect alone. The effects are such as concern the whole nature of man, and they are essentially of a bracing and tonic quality. Along with this test, however, he combines another of equal importance, that requiring in great literature a permanence of appeal. In general, he states, you should regard that greatness in art to be noble and genuine, with which appeals to all men in all ages. He insists on this test of time in positive fashion, and also gives reasons for the faith that is in him. When men, he argues, differing in all possible respects in their interests, their ways of life, their tastes, ages and languages, all agree, notwithstanding, in the views they hold on any particular subject, then the unanimity of a tribunal otherwise so discordant is surely undeniable proof of the justice of their verdict and of the value to be attached to works thus commended. Atkins. The fact is that Longinus has here called attention to one of the basic truths of literature and literary criticism, namely the inexhaustible vitality of all great art and its power of communicating life right down through the ages. He commends as touchstone the works of the great masters, and thus reminds us of Matthew Arnold and T.S. Eliot. He attaches great value to correctness, but prefers genuine greatness, allied to some defects, to a flawless mediocrity. It is greatness alone which compels admiration. Grandeur in literature appeals irresistibly to men, and this mere correctness cannot do. The eighth subheading is Longinus, practical criticism. His practical criticism, his comments on the literature in the concrete, constantly brought in by way of illustration, are also illuminating and interesting. By his insight and penetration, he succeeds in bringing to light not a few of the finest literary qualities of the ancient masterpieces. As David Dachez puts it, he asks quite different questions about literature from those asked by Plato and Aristotle. His vision is comprehensive, and everywhere he stresses the emotional and imaginative appeal of great literature. It is the creative imagination which modifies and transforms and produces works of beauty. Longinus is the first of the critics to emphasize his aspect of great literature, such as the works of antiquity. Then, methods of criticism: historical, comparative, and analytical. In his practical criticism, Longinus makes use of both the historical and comparative methods. He constantly views poetry, say, the works of Homer, in relation to their author and the age in which they are written, and so makes many interesting, original, and thought-provoking comments. Abercrombie calls him the first comparative critic of literature. He takes cognizance of a literature, say, Hebrew literature, which he knew and which is outside the pale of Greco-Roman literature, and by means of contrast brings out the salient characteristics of the work under discussion, qualities which would not have been brought out without such comparison. In this way, he suggests the universal nature of certain literary phenomena. His achievement in this field is indeed memorable. Longinus is also a pioneer in the field of analytical criticism. He analyzes passages from particular works to estimate the aptness of words, images, epithets, etc. used by the author. The best example of this analytical method is his analysis of one of the important love lyrics of Sappho. Then the ninth point and the other subheading is achievement as a critic, his greatness and originality. As a critic, Longinus displays a rare breadth and catholicity of outlook and a mind disinterested and free from prejudice. His estimates are essentially just and have been upheld by posterity. More important still, says Atkins, are those judgments of his that aim not at assessing but at interpreting literary values, those appreciations of his that enlighten and stimulate and enable us to read with quickened intelligence. Such passages are referred to by Gibbon as among the finest monuments of antiquity. Such passages are criticism of the highest kind, for they are based on sound psychological grounds and result from conscious analysis and delicate imaginative sympathy, says Atkins. There are, in short, many respects in which Longinus stands high as a judicial critic, and not least is the fact that he takes account of three separate literatures. Yet more significant still is his anticipation of modern criticism in those interpretations of his which lead to a more intimate understanding of ancient art and reveal in the clearest light his appreciation of the essence of literature. No doubt many of his remarks were literary commonplaces for his contemporaries. There is much in his treatise that is borrowed from earlier writers, but there is also much that is original and illuminating and is of permanent and universal significance. He is original in the importance which he attaches to emotion, imagination, and beauty of words. For him, literature is not a mechanical craft, but a thing of the spirit, of imagination, of feeling, and of the gift of communication. He thus becomes a pioneer in the field of aesthetic appreciation of literature. His great doctrine is that in great literature there are certain basic qualities which are permanent and universal, and that these qualities are embodied in the ancient masterpieces of Greek. In this way, he advocates a return to the standards, and above all the spirit of the classical Greeks. Again and again, he directs attention from the technical to the more elusive and spiritual side of literature. He hints in more than one place that formal rules may be disregarded at the bidding of a higher law, an important aesthetic truth which was to be rediscovered by modern critics. Elsewhere, he points out the inevitable and organic relation existing between thought and expression, or again, the atmosphere of infinite suggestion bound up with all great literature, while he also establishes one for all the survival value attached to great art. Atkins. Nor is he less suggestive in his remarks on the function of literature. Of the earlier didactic conception, he gives not a hint, and what is perhaps more surprising, he disregards entirely the Stoic theories of pleasure and persuasion. What he sees in literature is a great aesthetic force appealing irresistibly to the whole nature of man, uplifting, brushing, and stimulating, while nourishing something that lies deep in his nature. Atkins. With Aristotle, he perceives that literature works mainly through the emotions, and that its effect is one of a cathartic kind, though he nowhere alludes to catharsis theory. But in addition, he also brings to light something not covered by Aristotelian theory: the wider view attained by means of the imagination, the more comprehensive and more stimulating catharsis, which embraces the whole of the higher nature of man. And in his larger conception of aesthetic function, he approaches more nearly to modern ideas than did any of the predecessors. In the work as a whole, there is surprisingly little dead matter. On the other hand, there is much that is vital, expressed in memorable fashion. Nor is his style an unworthy medium of his thought, lacking though it may be in Attic purity of speech, reminiscent in some ways of Plato's manner, and rich with metaphors, compounds, and poetical expressions. His style, at the same time, has a peculiar intensity of its own, and this is due partly to his use of striking epigrams and picturesque similes, and partly to his use of long sentences brought to a triumphant, effective close. R.A. Scott James calls Longinus the first romantic critic, and he is romantic in his enthusiasm and exuberance, and in his emphasis on imagination, emotion, and the transport of great literature. But in the view of Atkins, it would be more correct to call him an exponent of genuine classical spirit. Throughout, he is concerned mainly with ancient Greek models, while his theory is solely based on the conception of art as the product of principles deduced from the practice of the past. Nor is this reverence for tradition the only classical element in his constitution. He is classical also in the balance he maintains between genius and unimpassioned hard work, in his sense of the need for fitness, selection, and a fine adjustment of means to ends, so that It is as one of the last of the classical critics that he figures primarily in ancient critical history. But while this is true, it is true also that he anticipates much that is modern in critical work. And this is shown by his concern with the essence rather than with the form of literature, his understanding of the part played by the imagination and feelings in creative work. His efforts are literary interpretation and appreciation, his widening outlook, and the variety of his judicial methods, features which were to reappear only after the lapse of centuries. The fact is that in him were combined faculties that were characteristic of the greatest of his predecessors. Like Aristotle, for instance, he based his theories on existing Greek literature. He likewise aimed at a rational explanation of literary phenomena, and his methods of theorizing are analytic, inductive, psychological, and historical. On the other hand, he is spiritually the antithesis of Aristotle, for nothing could be further removed from the cold intellectualism of Aristotle than the impassioned and suggestive teachings of Longinus, Atkins. Then the last subheading, his influence. Longinus, in short, is one of the greatest critics of antiquity, but the influence of his work has been comparatively slight. It was lost sight of during the Middle Ages and rediscovered at Renaissance. Its knowledge remained confined more or less to a few scholars. It was Boileau's translation of the treatise in 1674 that won recognition for it as a work worthy to rank with the works of Aristotle and Horace. After this, the treatise was frequently translated and edited throughout the 18th century, but still its true significance was not generally recognized. It had only a limited appeal. It was only in the later 19th century that its many merits were duly recognized. Now, the supreme qualities of the work are no longer in question. Ranking in antiquity with the greatest critical achievements, it remains towering among the other works of its class, and for sheer originality and power, it has not been surpassed. There are things in its pages that can never grow old, while its freshness and light will continue to charm all ages. All beautiful things, it has been said, belong to the same age, and the work of Longinus is in a sense contemporaneous with that of Plato and Aristotle and Coleridge. J.W.H. Atkins. Friends, thus we come to the end of this second chapter, that is Greco-Roman Criticism, Longinus on the Sublime. Thank you.